Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications at TryLifeMD.com? We're now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
It's fun to put on jeans that you couldn't get into 6 months ago.
Every morning, I look forward to getting on the scale.
For anybody who's struggling with their weight, it's a godsend.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. This week, has music copyright never had it so good? Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we are going to take a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. A week when, as part of celebrations marking the 70th anniversary of the UK singles chart, the BBC, an official chart company, revealed the most streamed tracks for each of those 70 years.
Now, I know what you might be thinking. What does that even mean? Because, hang on, last 70 years, that begins in 1952. There wasn't any streaming in 1952. How can there possibly be a press release with the most streamed track from 1952? No, back in the 1950s, those old school music fans, they just wouldn't embrace streaming. They were so obsessed with the old vinyl thing. So what's this about? And I must admit, it took me about 7 goes to write the paragraph of the story in the CMU Daily about this to try and explain what this is about. So basically, what they've done to celebrate the 70th anniversary of the UK singles chart is they have looked for which track released in each of those years has been most streamed since streaming began in the UK. So probably easier if I tell you that of all the tracks that were released in 1952... Gene Kelly's Singing in the Rain has been streamed the most since streaming was a thing in the UK. So hopefully now people understand what it is that this little celebration is about. And there was a little bit of a disagreement in my social feeds as to whether or not this was an interesting bit of data put out by the BBC and the official charts company or just a load of nonsense. But I mean, most chart things are ultimately a bit of nonsense, but I actually thought it was quite interesting because in a way these days the weekly chart that we get, because it's mashing together streaming data and sales data and download data and all of that sort of stuff, it is a bit of a nonsense. But actually it's quite interesting to me, of all the music that was released in 1964 or whenever, what is the most streamed track? Because sometimes it's not the track you would think it would be. It's not necessarily the biggest hit of that year, which is to say the track that was most successful in that year. In some cases, it's not even the biggest hit by the artist behind the hit. It's sometimes, you know, a sort of a less popular track put out by that artist, which is to say less popular at the time. But for some reason, since streaming became a thing and we had access to that vast catalogue of music on demand, that track, more than other tracks by the artist, have proven to be popular for one reason or another. So there are some constraints on this data because, I mean, for example, it might be that the most popular Beatles track just happened to be released in a year where there was another really big hit, which means that it wouldn't appear in these lists. But nevertheless, I thought they were quite interesting to look at. I don't know what you thought.
Yeah, it's lists are nice, aren't they? Everyone likes lists. And that's why I am now going to list all 70 of the tracks.
You don't need to, because it's a BBC thing. So needless to say, the BBC has basically put together a load of programmes which you can access right now on the BBC Sounds app. Can you do that anywhere in the world, or is it constrained just to the UK? I don't know. How does licensing work on that front? It used to be that BBC Radio Online was available everywhere, I think, and it was the TV iPlayer that wasn't. I don't know why I'm going down this tangent or why I didn't check this before we started. Point is, if you're in the UK for certain, who knows elsewhere, BBC Sounds have a whole load of programmes where basically they play all of these tracks grouped into the 50s lot, the 60s lot, the 70s lot, etc. They are airing on BBC Radio as well later this month, but who cares about that? You can go and listen to them in the BBC Sounds app now, and I'm sure Andy Malt will put you a link in the show notes for how you can do that. I say now, not now, obviously. You've got to audition a set list to listen to.
Yeah.
But now, as in, you know, at this period of history. But so don't give us all 70, but maybe were there some interesting things when you were scanning down the lists?
Well, I guess it was interesting that there are a few artists who appear multiple times in the list, which I guess you might expect. And I think probably there's three who appear three times. And maybe they are artists that you would expect. But the one that was surprising to me was that the Beatles only appear once in 1969 with Here Comes the Sun, which, if you're going to pick out the most popular Beatles songs, wouldn't necessarily feature on my list. But that's the only one that appears anywhere on this list.
Of course, the Beatles were quite late to the streaming party. They've been quite late to each phase of the digital music revolution. So they've
very
not,
slack.
Not been streaming as long. I don't know whether that had an impact on this. Or maybe it's that there are so many songs in the Beatles catalogue. And it isn't that, well, we're about to talk about the fact that Queen are one of the artists with three tracks in there. And obviously one of those is Bohemian Rhapsody, which you would expect. Whereas maybe within the Beatles catalogue, there's lots of tracks getting lots of streams, but no one track that gets all the streams. Although, don't quite know why. The track that made it was Here Comes the Sun. Maybe it's just that other tracks released in 1969 aren't being streamed much. So it sort of came through on a technicality. Who knows? But yeah, you said there were three artists that appear multiple times. In fact, they each appear three times. So Queen was one. Who were the other two?
So it's Fleetwood Mac, who appeared in 1976 with Go Your Own Way, 77 with Dreams, and 88 with Everywhere. Now, obviously, Dreams, I think it was Dreams, wasn't it? Had a big TikTok boost in the last few years. So that's probably why that's in there. And then Go Your Own Way, that's a big hit, isn't it? Everywhere, I suppose Everywhere's a hit. That's the longest gap. Most of these, the time between each one is not that long, but there's between Dreams and Everywhere, there's 11 years. So that's a stat for you, isn't it? Queen, as you say, are in there, first with Bohemian Rhapsody in 1975, Don't Stop Me Now in 79, and Another One Bites the Dust in 1980. And then you have to wait quite a long time before another artist appears three times. And do you want to have a guess who that is?
So who could the third artist be? When you say there's a big gap, are we talking about an artist sort of the streaming era who has been a big deal?
Oh, I would say so.
During streaming? I would say so. And are we talking British artist or American artist?
British.
Well, in which case, given it's streaming, it has to be Ed Sheeran, because obviously Adele was also a little bit wobbly on the old streaming thing at the start as well, wasn't she?
So she was.
Sheeran, yes. I assume, not Drake or Bieber.
And I bet she's kicking herself now.
Not Taylor Swift, it's Ed Sheeran. So which of his tracks made it to the list?
He's got Thinking Out Loud in 2014, Shape of You in 2017, and Bad Habits in 2021. Which of all of them, I suppose those are, I mean, probably songs that you would expect to hear, and they're not very surprising. Really. But as you say, yeah, Ed Sheeran, very much an artist of the streaming age and also very popular. So probably not surprising to see him in there three times.
But here's the question. When we regroup in another 70 years' time.
Yes, as I'm sure we'll be doing an episode then. Yeah.
Get that in the diary. Will Sheeran still be in there? Or will it be that there was something else released in 2014, 2017, 2021, which was not necessarily the big hit at the time, but because of some future sync or because something happens on TikTok or whatever the next TikTok is in the metaverse, that it suddenly becomes the big track of the 2010s and it outperforms Sheeran when the singles chart celebrates its 140th birthday. We will regroup in 70 years' time to discuss that. But for now, we need to stop talking about all of this chart nonsense because, and we can't stress this enough, we didn't actually gather here today to talk about any of this.
No, later on, we'll be discussing the changes over at Amazon Prime Music with more music, but less functionality. But first, former Spotify economist Will Page has said that music copyright has never had it so good with, by his calculations, the value of the wider music rights business now worth almost $40 billion worldwide. The total value of music copyright in 2021, says a new report from Will Page, was up by 18% to $39.6 billion, so close to $40 billion, and it would have been higher had the pandemic not impacted on certain music right revenue streams, such as live and public performance royalties. However, he notes, without the pandemic, streaming might not have accelerated at quite the same level, so it balances things out a bit.
Maybe it does. Maybe we would have still have been just below 40 billion even if the pandemic hit revenue streams had not been hit because the pandemic hadn't happened. So yes, this is what is now Will Page's annual study about the wider music rights business. And it's kind of become sort of the third of the big stat announcements that we look out for each year, because we always have that report put out in the spring by the International Federation of the Phonographic Industry, the IFPI. And basically what the IFPI does is they aggregate stats from record industries all over the world. And that gives us a pretty good oversight of what is happening with recorded music and the recorded music business. And usually we do a whole edition of Setlist about those stats every spring. Then we also have the report put out by CISAC. So CISAC is...
You're not giving CISAC its full name? You gave the IFPI its full name.
Something in French. The, what could it be in English? The Coalition of Insightful Songwriter. I give up. So CISAC, which is the global grouping of songwrite collecting societies, also puts out an annual report. Actually, its most recent report came out a couple of weeks ago. We didn't actually do an edition of Setlist on it this year. We did last year. Didn't do it partly because we were expecting these Will Page figures to come out. And the point is that although you have IFPI giving us figures for the record industry, the recorded music business, and that CISAC report gives us lots of information about the money coming in on the song side of the music rights industry, because remember, when we talk about music copyright, we're talking about both the copyright in recordings, but also the copyright in songs. And so we get the recording stuff from IFPI, and then the CISAC data gives us quite a lot of data about the song side, but not all of it. Because what the CISAC report is doing is it's aggregating data from all of the collecting societies on the song side of the business around the world. Now, it is true when it comes to songwrites and the money that comes into songwriters and the music publishers they work with, a lot of the money does come in through the collective licensing system. So in the UK, that would be through PRS and MCPS, the two collecting societies, and their counterparts around the world. And all of that is captured in the CISAC data. However, music publishers also directly negotiate sync deals with movie studios and gaming companies and ad agencies, and the upfront fees that are negotiated in those deals don't go through the collective licensing system, so they are not in the CISAC data. On the streaming side, the publishers do direct deals with some of their repertoire in some markets, so particularly Anglo-American repertoire. For example, in Europe, the deals are not done by the collecting societies, they're done by the publishers. Confusingly, some of that money does show up in PRS data and therefore CISAC data, but not all of it does. So there is streaming data missing as well. Also in the US, there's a new collecting society on the mechanical rights side called the MLC. Its data is not in the CISAC report because the MLC is not a CISAC member. So the point is that although the CISAC data covers a lot of the revenues on the song side of the business, it doesn't cover them all. There's also a little bit of overlap between RFPI and SYSAC in that when it comes to CD and vinyl sales, which are still part of the business, actually the RFPI and the SYSAC reports, for complicated reasons I won't go into, are both reporting the same money. So there are gaps and there are overlaps. So what Will Page does each year, and he was still at Spotify when he started doing this, but now he is an independent consultant, an author, and he goes out and he talks about this stuff, and he does it in his own right. And what Will does is he takes the RFPI data and the SYSAC data, he removes the overlaps, and then he says, okay, where are the gaps? And then he goes to see what data he can access in order to fill those gaps. So for example, there is a publication called Music and Copyright that does analysis of the music publishing sector outside of collective licensing. And actually this year, and we'll talk more about this in a moment, he's also brought in to his equations the production music companies that are likewise not part of the collective licensing system, which have become much more important in recent years. So the aim with the Will Page study is to capture all of the revenue coming in through labels and distributors and publishers and collecting societies all over the world to give us a picture of the wider music copyright business. And that's what we got. And as you said right at the start, the top level stat is growth continues to the extent that the business is now close to getting $40 billion a year in revenue worldwide.
Now, having crunched all of that data, he also compares how much money is flowing into the recording rights versus song rights. And according to his report, 66% is being generated on the recording side of the business, so by the record industry. And that means the song rights sector, so music publishing, accounts for 34%. And that is a shift in the favour of the record industry compared to 2020, when Page calculated that the figure was 64.9% on the recording side, 35.1% for songs. And that's an ongoing shift that's been underway for a few years. So when Will Page first did this study in 2014, it was 55% recordings and 45% songs. So a closer to even split. And the reason there is a difference is because of how income is split between recordings and songs, being different depending on the specific revenue stream. So with some revenue streams, recordings and songs do earn more or less the same, but with others, such as live music, only the songs earn. And with some revenue streams, the majority of the money will go to the recordings. And using Page's terminology, consumer spend revenue streams tend to favour recordings, while business licensing is good for songs. And in recent years, consumer spending on streaming has been the big growth revenue stream, while the licensing of live music and businesses that play recorded music in public was most heavily hit by the pandemic. And discussing the trend in which recordings increasingly dominate over songs, Page says in his report that that's because of the recovery in consumer spending on music, which traditionally favours labels over publishing. This has been accentuated by the pandemic's adverse impact on business licensing, which traditionally favours publishers over labels.
Now, while it is true that streaming favours recordings over songs, and obviously there has been quite a big debate, particularly in the songwriter community, as to whether or not that is fair and whether that should be changed. But it is true that even though more of the stream money is going on the recording side and the song side, both sides are benefiting from the ongoing streaming boom. And streaming now accounts for the majority of the wider music rights industry's revenue streams. We've known that has been the case in the recorded side for quite some time. But when you put all the stats together, as we say, Will Page does, he calculated that in 2021, 55% of the wider music copyright revenues came from streaming. That's up from 52% in 2020 and from just 30% back in 2017, which means that the entire industry is benefiting from the streaming boom. And that brings us to the positive statements within Will's report. He basically said, the great news is the value of copyright keeps on growing. Nostalgia has long been the biggest enemy of the music industry, a misplaced belief that we need to get back to the good old days when record labels used to sell CDs to stores by the weight of pallet. Nostalgia can mislead and misinform. Music copyright has never had it so good. Of course, we should acknowledge that That statement is definitely true for the industry at large. Plenty of artists and songwriters would say the industry may have never had it so good, but individual artists and songwriters, except in the Premier League, are still struggling in many cases. And of course, there are many, many reasons why that might be. And we've talked about them endlessly on this podcast, and we're not going to go into any of them now. But I suppose it is worth acknowledging that while the industry at large is very much on a growth trajectory powered by streaming, and that is great for individual artists and songwriters, certainly those operating more in the middle of the industry and within certain genres, etc., they're not necessarily seeing all of these benefits. But the positive headline statement remains.
As we've said, the streaming boom has also ensured that wider music copyright revenues have continued to grow despite the impact of the pandemic on things like live and public performance licensing. And Page also considers the extent to which the COVID effect on those latter revenue streams constrained the impact of the streaming boom on total revenues. Although, he adds, the COVID lockdowns and resulting spike in demand for home entertainment possibly boosted growth at the streaming services. And he writes, if we look at revenues across a two-year time span from pre-pandemic 2019 to the present day, we see how performing rights have suffered by $500 million. On one hand, had the world not entered lockdown and performing rights income had continued growing at 6% a year, then arguably they would be $1 billion higher today, $9.4 billion, not $8.4 billion, bringing the grand total past $40 billion. Yet, on the other hand, had the pandemic not happened, streaming may never have accelerated the way it did.
As we also have already noted, for the first time this year, Will Page also included stats relating to those production music firms that operate outside of the collective licensing system and which therefore do not appear in SysAc's data. So production music, I'm sure you're all aware, is music that is made to be put into audiovisual productions. So rather than commissioning a unique piece of music to go in your movie or your documentary or your advert or whatever it is, and rather than licensing a commercially released track, you can go to these production music libraries and pick music that works, and it's generally cheaper and easier to license. Now, the traditional production music industry, a lot of it went through the collective licensing system, so therefore is caught in the SysAc stats we talked about earlier. But not all production music appears in those stats because not all production music goes through collective licensing. And in more recent years, we've seen the significant growth of a new strand of the production music sector, which operates entirely outside of the collective licensing system and which was originally set up to basically service YouTube creators and other online creators who were needing a simple, cost-effective way to access music that crucially could be put in videos that then were available globally on demand on platforms like YouTube. And for various technical reasons we won't go into, even production music under the traditional system, going through the collective licensing system, isn't so simple for online creators on global platforms to navigate in order to access music. So we saw the emergence of these new production music companies aiming at those online creators operating outside of the collective licensing system. The most famous, almost certainly, and the market leader is Epidemic Sound. Has to be said that the model employed by Epidemic Sound has been controversial in some parts of the music community, and I'm pretty sure we've talked about that before on Setlist. We've certainly written about it in the CMU Daily. But despite the controversy, they are providing a service that is needed, and they have been very successful at it. And Will Page, for the first time this year, basically went to the music consultancy Midia to get some estimates on how much money is flowing outside of the collective licensing system to that part of the production music business.
Yeah, Midia estimates that that strand of production music was worth $250 million in 2021. And although, like you said, Epidemic Sound's approach to production music was originally targeted at online creators making videos, Page in his report also notes that podcasters are now a key customer for that service as well.
I can't believe that other podcasters aren't just writing their own music. That's what the sensible, savvy podcasters do, isn't it?
Yeah. Exactly. That's what you want to be doing. But apparently not. Apparently they're all spending their money with Epidemic Sound.
Yeah, unlike Andy Malt, creating his own original composition, which you can go and stream as a standalone track, let's not forget, on Spotify. if you want to.
But please do.
Turns out that most podcasters are not doing that. They're looking to license music from the music industry, but licensing music from the music industry is a freaking nightmare unless you go to the Epidemic Sounds of this world. So yeah, although originally set up with YouTube creators in mind, interesting that Will Page was honing in on the fact that there's an opportunity in the podcast space for that kind of music.
Yes, and also interesting and worth mentioning here, because Page notes that the music industry sees podcasts as something of a competitor now in terms of people's attention. So the report cites Pod News, which says that average weekly podcast listening is about 7 hours now, whereas music is somewhere around 9 hours. And he says the music industry's approach is to try to compete head on with podcasts to try to get people to move back to music and away from podcasts. But he reckons that isn't the approach that labels should be taking. He thinks that the issue of licensing music for podcasts being so difficult and pushing people to Epidemic Sounds is a sign that the record industry should finally get on top of that, work out a way of licensing music to podcasts and get that music into the podcasts rather than trying to get people to stop listening to the podcasts altogether. He writes, if commercial music wants to win back attention that's been lost to long-form podcasts, it needs to give up on bringing a horse to water, by which he means expecting podcasters to adapt to current licensing complexity, and develop solutions that bring water to the horse, or fight complexity with simplicity, to quote Epidemic Sound. That way, music can compete for scarce attention that might otherwise go elsewhere.
Interestingly, DDEX, which is the global standards organisation for metadata around streaming, recently put out a report about podcasts and music in podcasts and what that means for the way the music industry organises its data, which was interesting because it suggests that the labels are more actively thinking about how they can interact with the podcasting sector in a slightly more efficient way in terms of getting music into podcasts, you know, and whether that is people having speech-based podcasts, but where they have a bit of music at the start, or maybe they drop a track in the middle, or indeed, you know, trying to grow the part of the podcast business, which is more like music radio, where people are actually putting lots of music into their podcasts. Can we find a way to license that so that podcasters can make it work commercially, and they can do it legally, and they can get the song rights covered as well as the recording rights, but crucially, that the music industry could get an extra revenue stream, maybe a, you know, not Spotify-scale revenue stream, but a decent revenue stream to help further grow this music rights business. And I guess what Will Page is saying is if you don't, it's just further opportunities for the Epidemic Sounds of this world. And I think, as I said earlier, some people are critical of the way Epidemic Sound works and the fact that it operates outside of the collective licensing system and the deals that it does with the artists and songwriters it works with. And while I understand what those criticisms are, I also think what Epidemic Sound has done really well is it's spotted some gaps in the market where there are people who want to use music and who are willing to pay to use music, but who can't navigate the complexities of music licensing. And Epidemic Sound has filled those gaps, and it's filled those gaps very successfully. So I am sometimes a bit of a defender of Epidemic Sound, despite understanding the issues and controversies. But I guess what Will Page is saying here is, well, commercial music industry, labels, if you, labels and publishers, if you don't want more money going to the Epidemic Sounds of this world from things like podcasts, sort out licensing music into podcasts, and then a new revenue stream will grow, and we will get way beyond that $40 billion a year, which was a top line stat in this year's Will Page study, which I am sure Andy Malt will put a link to in the show notes that accompany this edition of Setlist.
And finally, on this edition of Setlist, Amazon has spruced up the music service available within its Prime membership scheme with a lot more music available, but more restrictions on functionality, which means users will now have access to 100 million tracks, up from 2 million, so that's quite a jump, but in the main, they will experience that music on shuffle rather than fully on demand.
So, of course, Amazon Prime is the service that Amazon offers to its customers that provides various different benefits. I think most people, like me, sign up to Amazon Prime to get the free next day delivery or sometimes same day delivery. I think that's one of the reasons for signing up. But once you're in there, you get access to other things. I guess Amazon's video on demand platform, you get access to a lot of the content in there as a Prime subscriber. But in amongst all of the other things that you get as a Prime member is access to Amazon Prime Music. I have to say, as an Amazon Prime customer, I've never actually opened up Amazon Prime Music. I think at one point they kept sending me emails offering me like a few pounds if I was to open it up. But I suspect not really for me. Having said that, I'm also a YouTube premium subscriber, which gets me access to YouTube Music, which I've never used. So maybe I need to sort out my subscriptions. Anyway, the point is that few people sign up to Amazon Prime for music, but in there, there is a music app. And music was added to Amazon Prime, firstly in the US back in 2014. It then launched here in the UK the following year. And in order to add a music element to Amazon Prime, Amazon basically committed to the music industry to share a portion of the subscription price that the Amazon customer pays each month or each year to the music industry. So it is a revenue stream for the music industry. Although, needless to say, the allocation of the Amazon Prime subscription that goes to music is much lower than what is being allocated from a Spotify subscription to the music industry, which meant that when Amazon first talked about adding a music element to Amazon Prime, they basically had to come up with a way of convincing the music industry that it was something they would want to do, even though, although there would be revenue, the revenue would be a much lower, certainly on a per user basis, than if they were launching a straightforward music streaming service. And the way they persuaded the music industry to get involved, actually initially Universal Music was a holdout, but eventually everybody got on board. And the way Amazon sold it was basically to say to the music industry, look, we know streaming is growing, more people are signing up, paying $10, £10, €10 a month to stream, and that's great. But realistically, there are many more consumers who, in the pre-digital age, probably used to buy a couple of CDs a year. And, you know, since the mid-2000s, they were probably buying those couple of CDs a year through Amazon. And if they were buying a couple of CDs a year, the chances of them paying £10, $10 a month for a standalone music service was very low. But maybe we could find a way of offering them a different kind of music streaming service where they would be paying a lot less, or as with Amazon Prime, they wouldn't actually be seeing what they're paying because it's bundled in with something bigger. And maybe we can find a way of offering those people a music service that's not as good as the full $10, £10 a month service, but nevertheless, they are interested in it, they use it, and you get a little bit of money from those customers because you're never going to get £10 a month from those customers. And there's a lot of those customers. So if you get a little bit of every Amazon Prime subscription in the world, well, actually, in total, that's quite a lot of money. And ultimately, the music industry bought that argument. But the question was, what is this Amazon Prime Music service going to look like? In that, basically, what we need is something that is definitely not as good as the fully on-demand £10 a month service, because what we definitely don't want is Spotify subscribers to all cancel their Spotify subscriptions and use this instead. But of course, by this point, Spotify was also offering its ad-funded free tier. So it had to be better than ad-funded free. So what were we going to do? And Amazon Prime came up with a solution which the music industry got behind.
Yeah, the general consensus was that lower priced streaming should be ad-free. So it's better than the kind of free tier of Spotify, but with either less music or less functionality than the fully on-demand premium services. So Amazon Prime Music went with the less music approach. So at launch, users only had access to about 1 million tracks, and the big new releases would also be missing. And since its launch, the catalogue has increased, but at a much more modest rate than the $9.99 services. So until these changes last week, users had access to about 2 million tracks. Subsequently, Amazon also expanded its wider streaming business, including the launch of Amazon Music Unlimited, a more straight-up Spotify competitor, and it also launched another cheaper option with less functionality, so that while users could access the full music catalogue, that music could only be played on a single device, such as an Amazon Echo smart speaker. And one of the challenges with the less music approach taken by Amazon Prime Music is that for many users, 2 million tracks is absolutely enough. And why would they want to upgrade to a standalone music service and pay more? And of course, as Amazon's own music streaming business expanded, it was much more motivated to upsell standalone music services to Prime members. Of course, you can exclude the big hits from Prime Music, although that makes the whole thing less attractive, especially to those more mainstream consumers, and that might make them less likely to engage and potentially be sold on a standalone music subscription. Meanwhile, on the industry side, labels wanted the service bundled in with Prime membership to have a smaller catalogue to set it apart from standalone music services, but at the same time, they wanted as many people as possible to be able to access their music.
Yeah, I remember going to an industry event where Amazon were presenting their various different music services and explaining how Prime Music had this smaller catalogue and that's what set it apart from the full-on $9.99 service, and everyone nodded and said, yeah, I get that. But then when it got to questions, all the indie labels in the room, their question was, how do we get our music into Prime? It's a bit like, do you remember when there was the big push by the record industry to introduce what we called windowing on Spotify, so that artists could make albums or individual tracks only available to premium subscribers for a few weeks before they went to the free users to try and make it feel like premium was better than free. Because if you wanted the latest Taylor Swift track, you had to be a premium user, and that would incentivize more people to sign up. And the industry pushed for that, and eventually Spotify said, all right, we'll set our system up to do that. And then it turned out no label wanted to do it. Because in the week of release, you want as many people as possible to be able to listen to your music, including all the free users. So yeah, so I think sometimes the music industry wants to make the free services and the low price services not as good because we ultimately want more people to sign up to premium. But then every artist wants as many people as possible to listen to their music. And that was one of the problems, I guess, with the smaller catalogue approach to Prime, which means that maybe it was inevitable that Amazon would change how Prime Music works at some point as the whole industry progressed.
Yeah, so it's now becoming a less functionality rather than a less music service, with that catalogue jumping from 2 million to 100 million tracks. But within Prime, it will be more of a personalised radio experience, with full on-demand functionality becoming available once a user upgrades. There will be some playlists within Prime Music which will be available on demand and which can be downloaded for offline listening. But the main offer is those 100 million tracks on shuffle and some ad-free podcasts, which you've got to have the podcast in there because that's what people really want.
Yeah. Who cares about the music? It's all about having access to podcasts without the terrible adverts. I don't know if you heard an advert at the start of the decision of Setlist. I think it depends where you're listening to the podcast, whether or not there is an ad in there. But I think what Amazon...
I assume it would still be in there on Amazon Prime because they can't just go stripping out our revenue stream.
Except not with Setlist because, I mean, we're getting into some nitty-gritty here that our listeners do not need to know. But we currently distribute with a company called Audio Boom. But if we were to distribute with Audio Boom's competitor, Acast, following on this announcement, Amazon announced a deal with Acast. So I think if we were to put our podcast through Acast, and it's the distributor usually with podcasts who puts those ads in at the start. Obviously, those podcasts where the podcaster does some product placement in the middle, there's nothing any distribution platform can do about that. But where it's a sort of a straight ad at the start, it's usually the distributors who put those ads in. So in our case, it would be Audio Boom. If we were using Acast, it would be Acast. And as I understand it, under this deal that Amazon and Acast have done, is if you're accessing the podcast within Amazon Prime, the Acast ads will not be there. And therefore, I assume Amazon is paying a little bit of money to Acast to pass on to the podcasters to compensate for the fact there's no ads. I don't know, because I don't think the announcement of that deal gave that much information. But yeah, there is an interesting podcast element to all of this as well. We're really here to talk about the music bit, although it has to be said that when the VP of Amazon Music, Steve Boom, gave a quote, he did also talk quite a lot about the podcasts.
Yeah, he said, "When Amazon Music first launched for Prime members, we offered an ad-free catalogue of 2 million songs. I mean, actually, as we've said, 1 million songs, but who's counting?" He went on, "which was completely unique for music streaming at the time. We continue to innovate on behalf of our customers and to bring even more entertainment to Prime members on top of the convenience and value they already enjoy. We can't wait for members to experience not only a massively expanded catalogue of songs, but also the largest selection of ad-free top podcasts anywhere at no additional cost to their membership."
But unless a deal is announced with Audio Boom in the next few weeks, or we move and go over to Acast, alas, I don't think you'll be able to get an ad-free set list within Amazon Prime, which, I mean, at the end of the day, is the main reason people would sign up for Prime in the first place. So, big announcement from Steve at Amazon this week, but not that big. Maybe there's a bigger announcement to come when we make it that you can get Setlist ad-free as an Amazon Prime member, on the off chance that's something anybody out there is interested in.
Yeah, I think, I mean, anyone who is thinking, oh, I'd like to switch over to Amazon to get ad-free podcasts, I mean, I don't have the stats in front of me, but I think possibly 4 people currently listen on Amazon. I don't think this is going to be a big issue for anyone. So carry on listening to the ads.
I guess there is an upside here in that the theme from Setlist, which, as we mentioned earlier, is available on streaming services. I haven't checked this, but my assumption is that Amazon had not selected that to go in the selected, curated 2 million catalogue previously available on Amazon Prime. But now that they're making available 100 million tracks, which basically is every nonsense track anybody has ever uploaded into the music distribution system, you will be able to access the Setlist theme tune within Amazon Prime, although I guess given that it's a kind of a shuffle thing, it would require the Amazon algorithm to push it into somebody's feed, so maybe that would never happen. So maybe actually this is a load of nonsense. I don't even know why we're talking about it. We should have spent half an hour talking about those 70 tracks in the official chart company's anniversary chart. That's what we should have done.
Well, we pretty much did, didn't we?
And we should stress that now is the moment when you are allowed to go into the BBC Sounds app to listen to those, if that is something that does interest you.
Yes, but first, do listen to the outro, because maybe I've changed it. Maybe I've put some important information in there that you need to listen to and not skip through. So, what does it say here? That's all we've got time for on this edition of Setlist. If you want to read more about anything we've discussed here, go to the show notes, which you'll find in your podcast player, or at setlistpodcast.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the show, rate and review the show, and if you have anything you want to tell us, email us, setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Malt and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.